All right, this hour, the interactive portion of Coast to Coast. We'll take your phone calls with Dr. Matt McCarthy as we talk about his incredible book called Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic, and we really need to stop the epidemic. We'll be back with him and your calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Matt McCarthy with us, of course, and we're taking your calls as we talk about the prospects of superbugs. And is this a worldwide epidemic, Matt?
Oh, yes, it certainly is worldwide. And we're only starting to fully understand exactly how the superbugs are affecting each country and each continent. We don't even really know what's going on in Africa, for example, because we don't have the diagnostic tests to figure out where the superbugs are. But we know that they're all over Manhattan and they're all over New Delhi. And we're presumably, you know, going to find them every place we look. And that's going to be something that we learn a lot more about in the next few years.
What has been the most difficult medical case that you have witnessed, been a part of?
Oh, that's such a good question. the cases that are difficult because of the ethical challenges, but in terms of strictly scientific, you know, superbug-related challenges, I frequently see cases where there's a bug for which there is no drug, that we don't have an antibiotic or an antifungal to treat the patient, and we end up having to amputate a limb, for example, because we cannot control the infection from spiraling out from, say, a foot towards a patient's knee or from their hand towards their arm. And those are the agonizing cases, the ones that keep me up at night, are the ones where we don't have a treatment and we're left going back to a treatment that we used in the 1800s, which was, you know, essentially a hacksaw, and returning to, you know, the operating room. Those are the cases that really crush me.
Medicine back in the 1800s, how did they handle these kinds of things? Like you just said, a hacksaw?
Well, you typically died. You mentioned sepsis at the top of the show.
Yeah.
That was one of the leading causes of death. You got a blood infection, and that was it. There was no treatment, and that's why life expectancies were so short. You know, in the early 1900s, the life expectancy was like age 47 for a man. And by the time we, you know, had antibiotics, that started to change. And we called the 1950s the golden era of antibiotic development because we discovered so many life-changing drugs during that decade. And then we kind of took our eyes off the ball and we started focusing on other diseases like heart disease and cancer. And it was during the 60s and 70s when we were looking in another direction that the superbugs started to mutate and started to come for us, frankly. And now we are finally recognizing the full extent of the problem at a time that, as I mentioned, the pharmaceutical companies are less interested in making new drugs, new antibiotics.
Matt, wasn't the bubonic plague, was that some kind of infectious disease?
Absolutely. Many of the great plagues throughout history were infectious diseases. And I was giving a book talk the other night, and a guy said to me, you know, in the Bible, they say that locusts were cast upon the earth as a judgment for human behavior. Are superbugs similarly a judgment for our poor behavior? And, you know, it kind of caught me off guard, but there's an argument to be made that it is, that, you know, our poor prescribing practices and our poor use of these precious drugs has put us in a position where we're trying to, you know, combat a new a stealth menace that's been coming for us.
Let's take some calls. They're lining up here for you. We'll start with Ursula in Meade, Washington. Welcome to the program. Hi, Ursula.
Good evening, gentlemen. Dr. McCarthy, in 2015, I crossed paths with Dr. Freya Harrison from the UK, and she was doing and actually it began as an English report, and it was Bald's Leech book, which was written in 10th century. And what they did was they did an eye salve potion that was written in there that contained a variety of alums mixed with ox gall and wine and set in a brass container for 9 days, and they used it to wash the eye with. And what Dr. Harrison found was that this compound actually killed MRSA and a lot of other different problem
you're,
things. And as a nurse, I get staph all the time, and I just slap iodine on it, and it kills it. And when I pick up Walmart conjunctivitis, oh, yay, silver.
Well, would you believe that I reference Bald's Leech book and that very salve that you mentioned in my own book? I talk about how we are returning to these antiquated and old-timey
old remedies, yeah.
Old remedies, but the thing that you're mentioning, I actually write about, and what I highlight that because not only is it interesting to return to an old treatment, I want to examine how difficult it is to bring that to the market, to the, getting FDA approval. The problem is when you do a research like that, the researcher that you mentioned, it still costs hundreds of millions of dollars if you ever want to bring that treatment from Bald's Leech book into FDA approval. And the problem is nobody wants to take that kind of risk right now. And as a result, we have fewer and fewer treatments for MRSA, which you mentioned, and it's one of the most common superbugs out there. We're running out of treatment options for MRSA, and I think increasingly we're going to see a return to old-timey remedies. The question will be, who is going to pay to get those drugs approved by the FDA? That's going to be a substantial cost that no one wants to foot that bill.
Matt, what do you think of hand sanitizers that are loaded with alcohol?
I use hand sanitizers before I walk into every patient's room. It's one of these mandated things. So I wash my hands with hand sanitizers 25 times a day. You know what? And if I think about it, I do it before I leave the patient's room as well. So more like close to 50 times a day. So I've got these incredibly dry hands because of those sanitizers. Do they work? Maybe. Probably.
Well, here's kind of a weird question, but you go to a restroom, you wash your hands, and then you're faced with the door handle. What do you do?
Yeah, the big picture here is that if you have an intact immune system, if you're not somebody who's always getting infections, then you don't have to worry about picking up a superbug on that door handle. We've done studies at my hospital, researchers have studied the superbugs that are on in grocery stores and on subways. They're all around us, and that doesn't mean we have to be fearful that they're going to attack us. If you're somebody who is otherwise healthy, these things are in our environment. And, one study found that up to 5% of doctors and nurses have superbugs inside their nostrils.
Whoa.
The thing is, they're not.
We probably all do.
Yeah, they're colonized. There's a big difference between being infected with a superbug and being colonized by it.
I happen to know if you go to sleep with your mouth open, spiders walk in and out of your mouth all night.
Yeah. No, but you can have superbugs sit on your arm and they're not causing any problem. As long as your skin is intact, you're okay. And I think that's one of the messages that I want to get out to people is to understand your risk so that you can know what to do about it.
Now, what do you mean by skin intact? Does that mean no cuts or anything?
Yeah, so I see patients who get a big cut on their arm, and then all of the bacteria that had been otherwise just living harmlessly on the skin are able to seep into that cut and get into the blood and cause some real problems. But if you don't have any of those kind of cuts, if you're just living your normal life, you may have superbugs on your jeans, on your hands, and they're not causing a problem. And that's something that people don't always recognize.
Does triple biotics work? The little creams that did you get at the drugstores?
Somewhat. It depends on the infection. For a tiny little infection, the kind of thing that you might get from like cut it with a razor or your kid scrapes their knee, it's fine. But for larger infections, we typically don't use one of those triple antibiotics. We have to go to the more powerful, the heavy hitters.
What is tetanus, exactly?
What is tetanus?
Yeah.
Tetanus is something that is in the soil. It is a spore that, if it gets into your system, can cause one of the most painful types of death that you could imagine.
Really? Is it like anthrax in a different way?
I write about how tetanus can cause lockjaw, where it will paralyze the muscles in your face. So that as you're suffocating, you've got this perverse smile on your face.
Oh.
Because, it's a horrible way to go. And it's one of the things that we used to see during World War I. Soldiers were getting lockjaw and they were suffocating. And thankfully, we have a tetanus vaccine to prevent this. But it's one of those bugs out there that, you know, periodically can get you.
I think suffocating may be the worst way to die.
Yeah,
not being able to breathe is horrible.
We could take some calls and see if people think there's a worse way, but I might be right there with you. That suffocation is the worst way to go.
I mean, years ago, I burned my throat with pizza rolls. It's for some websites, it's an ongoing joke. But my throat swelled up. Tom took me to the doctor the next day. He insisted. And the doctor said, had I swallowed this thing, this little pizza roll, which had like molten lava on the inside, had I swallowed it, he said, you wouldn't be talking today. And I went,
oh my God,
because, you know, I spit it out because it was so hot. But you don't realize how naturally you swallow when you go to sleep at night. You know, it's just constantly moving.
Well,
but when you can't do that and you have to do it thinking, it's the worst feeling ever. It's horrible.
Yeah, and, you know, you were asking me about, you know, tough medical cases I've seen. The most incredible medical thing I've seen is when a patient's throat is swelling up and a doctor sticks a ballpoint pen into the throat and creates a bypass so the patient doesn't suffocate.
Oh.
It's called an emergency tracheotomy. And you just got to find the right spot, and you just jab into the throat, and you create a new airway.
You puncture it, I guess.
Time. Yep, and you'll never forget it.
Oh. Next up, J.D. in Indianapolis. Welcome to the program. Hi, J.D.
Hi, Mr. Norrie. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you to your staff. Dr. Matt, I thought I heard on the National Public Radio that there is a small institute, I want to say in Ghana, Africa, where they're studying how viruses can attack these bacteria. But the challenge is you have to find the right virus or the right bacteria that the bacteria has a certain virus. The virus likes to eat that certain kind of bacteria. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
Absolutely. You heard correctly. This is one of the most exciting new advances in the treatment of infections. Those viruses are called bacteriophages. And what we're trying to do is we're figuring out how to harness those bacteriophages to destroy the bacteria. The problem is that they are very narrow spectrum. You hear about like a broad spectrum antibiotic that can kill all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
These viruses, which are known as bacteriophages, only kill a specific type of bacteria, which means that they can only be used in limited cases. And no company wants to get a drug that's so limited. So even though it's exciting to hear about these, you know, the stuff going on in Ghana and looking for these viruses that are going to eat up the bacteria, the problem is no one knows how to make a profit off of them. And that's really unfortunate, because this is a remarkable new way that we could be setting, we could be punching superbugs back. But unfortunately, it's an issue of dollars and cents that's limiting the development of these things. But it's a great question.
Is the FDA doing their job, in your opinion?
I do think so, yes. They have a very tough job. It's easy to point fingers and say that they're moving too slowly. I wish that more drugs were approved. One of the things people don't realize is that just because an antibiotic is approved by the FDA, it doesn't mean that your hospital is going to carry it. And in fact, hospitals have to decide by voting on what drugs to carry.
The committees do that, right?
Committees do. That's right. I'm part of the committee. And what we will do is we'll decide, should we carry a new antibiotic that costs $4,000 a dose or $8,000 a dose? And for infectious diseases, sometimes we decide, you know what, this drug is simply too expensive. And I don't think people always recognize that many of the top new antibiotics are simply not on the shelves of your local hospital.
You know, these pharmaceutical commercials scare the living daylights out of you. When you hear the disclaimers at the end that they've got an announcer who speaks at double time speed, you know, they say, you know, you have to be very careful when you take this pill. Your legs will fall off, your eyes will pop out, you know, all that stuff. I mean,
yeah, well, I run clinical trials, and I have to talk to patients about the potential side effects. And so I think a lot about that. And, you know, if you just list 85 different side effects, well, nobody's ever going to want to do your trial.
Right.
Trying to figure out what is meaningful and what's not. You know, a lot of people, if you just ask them, how do you feel? They'll say, I feel lousy. And so you're starting from a position where you've got to recognize where the patients are at and what the side effects are that are meaningful to them. But to answer your question, I think the FDA is doing a pretty good job. I think they could be doing better in spots, but they're working aggressively to approve new antibiotics.
Let's go to West Los Angeles. Larry's with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Larry, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks, George. So listen, for your guest, Dr. McCarthy, I just got out of, as I told producer and screener Tom, I just got out of emergency hernia surgery, inguinal surgery over at Cedars. And it was unfortunately a long overdue surgery, which I let go, and it became incarcerated, and I got bowel obstruction. They had NG tube, everything. Anyway, bottom line is they gave me among the narcotics that I didn't want to take, didn't work. They gave me Flagyl and Cipro, and just a few doses. And I got to tell you something. After the third day, they wanted to continue it for 10 days. I said, no, I'm done.
Yep.
You can't, yep. No white blood cell count, nothing to justify it. And I'm getting sick. I couldn't eat. I had esophagus infection. I was acid reflux. And it wasn't until I started taking, I had somebody bring in some BioK Plus, which I take off and on, very expensive stuff, but it works. And I took, the BioK Plus for 4 days, and finally, luckily, it restored my digestion and I could eat.
Good for you.
I'm not into it. I want to recommend something. I'm talking real fast because I want to get all this in. I want to recommend something for you to look into, and that's for you, George. And I told Tom, as you well know, a couple of years ago, when he had that long running flu or whatever, is I suggest that you tell all your listeners to look into the clinical trials of standardized grape seed, not grapefruit seed, extract. And look in the International Journal of Clinical Trials, a study I think I just saw a few minutes ago back in India in 2016. And it's effective microbial, antifungal, antibacterial, against staph and everything. I highly recommend that.
Well, what else works too is colloidal silver, Matt. Did you know that?
Cool. Yeah, that was my grandfather. He used to tell me that, and I love that
right.
Stuff. Hearing about your case there, Larry, that the word that alarmed me was that it was incarcerated. I know just how painful that can be to have an incarcerated hernia. So you did not just go through the run-of-the-mill surgery. I can tell you went through a real ordeal, and the fact that the probiotics helped, I'm so glad something did, because that kind of a surgery and those kind of complications can be brutal. And I certainly will look into the grape seed that you recommended. Thank you for passing that along.
Matt, where do we get your book, Superbugs?
Superbugs is available wherever books are sold. And
perfect.
So I did the audio book as well, if you're interested in that.
Good. Well, we've got a lot of people who are visually impaired, so that would help them a lot. Superbugs, the race to stop an epidemic. Matt's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We are going to come back in just a moment and take final phone calls with him before we talk about Planet X next hour on Coast to Coast AM. So just make sure you get to our website daily and take a look at all the guests' materials. And we've got some new pictures up there for next hour as well. You might as well look at them pretty soon, too. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're back with our final segment with Dr. Matt McCarthy and your phone calls as well. Matt, what was the impetus to get you involved in not only studying these kinds of resistant infections, but also fighting them?
Well, what I noticed was that patients had a lot of questions for me. I show up in the hospital every morning. People want to know, why are you giving me an antibiotic? What is the infection that I have? What's going to happen to me? And I noticed that there was this gap in what I understood and what I wanted my patients to understand. And I wanted to write a book that was accessible to people so that the next time you step in a hospital, you'll understand where your doctor is coming from. You may not agree with the doctor, but you'll at least have a sense of how they are trained to make decisions about infections and antibiotics.
Is it true more people are dying in the hospital because of infections than anything else?
Well, I don't know if it's more than anything else, but we keep very close tabs on the infections that happen because they occur in our hospital. It's a rare occurrence at my hospital because we put such a premium on preventing that. But
that's smart.
It is something that we're always worried about, but it's something that we're judged on, and you know, we keep close tabs on it.
I mean, the people, for example, who clean the hospital floors, do they wear any special garb or anything like that to make sure they don't get it?
We have disinfection policies that are constantly being updated and changed so that the orderlies or the you know, the housekeepers are up to date with what is the best way to prevent an infection from spreading. And our hospital has been ranked best in New York for 16 years and running, and that's one of the reasons is that we don't just treat the cleaning of a room like a ho-hum ordeal. It's included in the medical care that we provide, is that it's up to date and, you know, state of the art.
Matt, if there was somebody who just does not get an infection, I mean, you throw anything at him and he just won't get an infection. He's got this incredible built-up immune system in his system and his bloodstream and everything. Could his blood be used as some kind of formula to fight this?
Good question. You know, we study patients like this. There are people who are genetically impervious to HIV, and we study their genes to understand how that is. And we occasionally study people who are impervious to other types of infections. And it's not the kind of thing where you can bottle their blood and give it to other people to protect them, but you can figure out why they're impervious to infections and then try to design treatments based on that knowledge. So we're a little ways away from bottling it, but you know, to prevent an infection, I think some of the things to start with are getting a good night's sleep, not drinking too much, exercising, things that are kind of hard to do, but are a good first step for anyone.
Let's go to Helen in the Bronx in New York. Welcome to the show. Hi, Helen.
Hi, George. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. Long-time listener.
Thank you.
Since the Art Bell days. Dr. McCarthy, I've had two life-threatening infections in my life. The most recent was in February 2018. I got E. coli bacteria into my blood through a urinary tract infection.
Oh, geez.
And it affected my spinal cord. And it affected all the vertebrae in the back. So I had to be operated on. And my surgeon put two rods and a cage in my spine. And I'm still recovering from it today. But this is my second infection, which was life-threatening. I'm just afraid I'll get a third one. You know, I just would like to know what I can do.
The condition that you're describing is called urosepsis, when it starts in the urine and gets into the blood. And then, you know, one of the devastating things that can happen is when it reaches the spinal cord.
The spinal cord, is that easy to affect, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, if you get an infection on your spine, I write about in my book about my father-in-law getting an infection on his spine and it paralyzed him. And I went from being the doctor who was treating people to being the terrified family member. So when I hear about your listener's case, it reminds me of my family members. And what he was left asking was, what can he do to prevent this? And I think that's exactly what you were wondering. Some cases, there's nothing you can do. We learned from my case, my father-in-law had a genetic condition that predisposed him to staph infections. Your listener was saying that she has an E. coli infection. And E. coli is everywhere. It's one of the most common bacteria in our environment, and there can sometimes be nothing you can do to stop it from happening. I know that's not a reassuring thing to hear, but it's not the kind of thing that we can easily control.
Okay, let's go to more calls. Thanks, Helen. Take care of yourself. It's bad enough you have to worry about injuring your spinal cord. Now you have to worry about an infection of the spinal cord.
Yeah.
But that's what meningitis is, isn't it?
Yep, that's exactly right.
Next up, we go to James in Beaumont, Texas, east of the Rockies. Good morning, James. Go ahead.
Good morning. I have a short list of things that have proven to be effective, you know, for instead of antibiotics. I would like for you to sort of rate each one of them real quickly.
All right.
About five different ones. Okay, matching frequencies like model oscillatory rate, you know, that explodes the pathogens by using a positive square wave. Have you heard of that?
Using have heard of it. We don't.
Okay, let me move to the next one.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, how about MMS, Miracle Mineral Solution with the sodium chloride? It's used as a water disinfectant, but, you know, Jim Humble, your guy that helped cure a lot of malaria with that out in the jungles, MMS, is sodium chloride.
Yep.
Is that pretty good?
Yeah, so, I mean, these things, the challenge is that a lot of people have anecdotal experience where they say it worked for me and it worked for people I know. And then what we want to see is the systematic study of these things to be able to say this will definitely work for the next patient I give it to. And that's where things get a little tricky. I've definitely heard good experiences with both of the things you've mentioned.
Matt, does simple common sense play any role here?
You know, common sense is one of those things that I wish it was easy to pass along the common sense of preventing infections, but these things are everywhere, and I don't want people to feel like if you get an infection, you did something wrong.
It's over, right?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, by the same token, there is some common sense. You know, if you have an open flesh wound, don't go into a dirty body of water. You know, if you are getting chemotherapy and have a weakened immune system, you don't want to go into a musty basement and clean out the mold. Doing things to protect yourself can be a complicated task. And so I don't know that everyone is aware of what they can do to protect themselves.
Why is the body, Matt, so susceptible to infection? I mean, you can get ear infections, eye infections, mouth infections. I mean, everything can be infected.
There's stuff all around us, and our body is pretty good at protecting ourselves. But I got a buddy who's in his 30s, and he said, why do I get all these infections? And I said, do they come on after you go out drinking? And he said, yes. And I said, and you don't get any sleep? He said, yes. And said, you eat garbage. Sometimes we do things that make our immune system get a little weaker. But a lot of times these things are just all around us. And you know, stroke of bad luck, something could, you know, go down your throat or could, you know, go inside a wound. And next thing you know, you're in the emergency room.
And what exactly is an infection?
So you're hitting upon something I spend a lot of time trying to determine the difference between an infection and colonization. So an infection is when a pathogen, so some sort of microbe, gets into your body and elicits an immune response. So what we do is we look under the microscope. Let's say we did a biopsy of your skin on your arm.
All right.
We thought that there was an infection. We might see some bacteria there.
Because what are the symptoms? It flares up, it's red, it's sore.
Let's say you had a big red swollen thing on your arm. We do a biopsy. We look under the microscope. If we see white blood cells there, mm-hmm. that's a sign that your immune system is responding to an infection. This is your body's way of saying, this thing should not be here, and we're going to attack it. That's a clear sign of infection. If we don't see any white blood cells, we're less likely to call it an infection.
What creates the pain?
So the pain is your immune system attacking that infection and surrounding it and causing the swelling. Your blood vessels open up, and all kinds of chemicals your body makes go to that site of infection and attack it. And that attack process can actually be painful.
Is it not true that a fever means that your body is trying to fight some kind of infection in your system?
Yes. Yeah, so fever, your body, the body's response to an infection often involves a fever. The tricky part for me is when I think somebody has an infection but no fever. And we're trying to parse out why that happens. And sometimes we see a fever but no infection. I see that a lot in the emergency room with drug overdoses. Somebody pops a bunch of pills and they show up dazed and confused and they got a really high fever. And it's not from an infection. It's from the MDMA that they popped and trying to figure out, you know, who needs antibiotics and who doesn't.
But generally, if we're, you know, we've got a fever and it's fighting an infection in the body, why do people then want to lower the fever?
Oh, just because it's uncomfortable.
But we're minimizing its use then, aren't we?
So the fever itself is not curing the infection.
It's not.
It's the byproduct of it.
Okay.
So your body is doing this attack, and it causes the temperature to raise. It's uncomfortable. We give Tylenol to lower that fever, but that's not weakening the attack on the infection at all.
John in Portland, Oregon. Take it away, John. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Okay, John. Thanks.
Right. Okay, I got a comment and a question.
All right.
When I was laid off from my work, I used to work for Freightliner. When I was laid off, I went and I worked at the hospital and housekeeping. And the housekeeper put me up in OR. And I scrubbed it and I and everything else and all this and that. And the woman was really, really strict, the supervisor. About a week later, she comes down and I go, oh, my God, I'm in trouble. And she walks up to the housekeeper and she says, I want to tell you right now. And the housekeeper said, yes. And she says, for the first damn time, she says, OR has been sterile.
See, because of you. Way to go, John.
And she looked at me and she said, you don't work for housekeeping no more. And I says, I don't. And she says, no, you work in OR. My question is, I have a neighbor who is on dialysis. He's been on it for years and everything else. He has now come down with MRSA. And he came over and I says, hey, guy, you got that super bug. I says, I like you and all this, that, but you have to go home. His grandkids come over to the house after school, because their mom is working. Is that safe
for you?
Oh,
what do you think, Matthew?
This is a great question. And one that I get asked a lot. If you know that he has MRSA, the kids can still go to the house. They just should be careful not to have much skin to skin contact with him.
But how do you know?
Yeah, I know this is really difficult. You have to be careful with kids, but they should still be allowed to go over to the house, especially if you're aware of that MRSA is there. You know, MRSA is everywhere. It's in our grocery stores. It's certainly in our gymnasiums and our schools. So it would be a mistake to say that we can't have kids going over to a house where someone has MRSA.
Well, I think he was also concerned about them coming over to see him.
Right. So, you know, these are really tricky conversations, especially if you're on dialysis. Many of the treatments for MRSA are very difficult to take, so the patient may have the infection for longer than you would be expecting. The thing that I always do is have the patient talk to their doctor and say, how long do you think I will be infectious for? And you can get an answer to that. You know, I can't give that answer over the phone because I don't know this patient, but I would say, if you can find out that answer, say to your neighbor, go ask your doctor how long you're contagious or you're infectious, and that way it can give everyone some peace of mind.
Absolutely. Matt, give out your website, sir.
DrMattMcCarthy.com.
Super. And the book, Super Bugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. How about the other ones? Are they available still?
Yep. Odd Man Out and The Real Doctor. We'll see you shortly.
God, I would have loved you pitching for the Detroit Tigers.
In another life.
You got it. Thanks, Matt, for being on the program. Come on back again. Can we use you as an expert in case there's some epidemic that pops up?
Yeah, I would love to come back.
Okay, we'll keep in touch. Up next, we're talking about Planet X right here on Coast to Coast AM.